This is the Paper Planes podcast, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
The best thing you can do as a business is to be generating reviews and then using social media to be pushing the products that you've done. The number of manufacturers in the Australian market is actually the highest in the world. Everyone now just looks at a Google review before they do business.
Welcome to episode 59 of the Paper Planes podcast. Welcome back. If you have listened to any one of our shows before, it is great to see you again. If you are here for the first time, thank you very much for joining us. And where have you been for the other 58 episodes is all I want to know. My name is Simon Dell. I run an agency called Paper Planes. You can find us at www.flypaperplanes.com. And today we have on the show a gentleman by the name of Simon Clark from a company called Motorama. Now, first of all, the disclaimer is that Motorama, or at least a couple of Motorama's brands and businesses, are clients of ours. So I work with Simon Clark and have been for the past 2 or 3 months. So just so everybody understands that this is not a promotional show for Motorama or any of their sub-brands. This is a genuine interview where we talk about some of the challenges when it comes to selling cars. Some of the challenges, current challenges, past challenges, and future challenges. We do talk about a couple of the, or at least one of the brands that we work on with the guys, which is called Motopool, which is a car subscription service. But we also talk a lot about other things like electric cars, autonomous cars, the disruption in the marketplace, diversification, etc., etc., all those, and some of the brands that they work with, which include Holden, Toyota, Kia, Ford, so on and so forth. So lots of conversations about marketing and selling in the car space, which is traditionally a challenging place to be in. And I would say that as from the consumer point of view as well. A lot of consumers get very, very apprehensive and concerned about buying a car. It is a big purchase. Is an expensive purchase. I think it's the second most expensive thing most people will ever buy. So also hear about how Motorama are trying to make that experience more enjoyable and stress-free for the end user. So great little chat with Simon Clark. As I say, he's the group marketing manager of Motorama. He's also worked for Toyota for a number of years. And then a long, long time ago, back in the 90s, he used to work for John Deere. So we have a little bit of a conversation about John Deere because that's a very famous, high-quality American brand. Now, before we jump into the interview, the usual requests that if you could rate and review us on iTunes. We've had quite a few new reviews and ratings on iTunes, but we can always do with more. And the more that we get, the more we are found in iTunes and the more people listen. So that's great. There's also our Instagram page, which is flypaperplanes.co, which is the business Instagram, but we also post a lot of the stuff on there from the podcast. And if you want to come and find us, you can find me on LinkedIn. You can find paperplanes.co on Facebook and Twitter. Just come and find us somewhere, anywhere. I love it when, you know, if people want to connect with me on LinkedIn, just let me know that you listen to the podcast. That's great. And finally, Gilberto, our crazy Colombian podcast producer, who is doing lots of other podcasts for people here and there. So if you want to start your own podcast, he's the man to talk to. Thepodcastboss.com, not .com.au, as I discovered the other day when I accidentally typed in the wrong URL. But yeah, so talk to Gilberto. All the links for all of those will now be in the show notes. They are live links if you're listening to it on Audio Boom, but you can see those links in iTunes or Spotify no matter where you are. So, and probably the last thing is that if you actually want to read any of these transcriptions for any of our podcasts, we're actually starting to get them all up on the website. flypaperplanes.co is the website that will take you to what you need to find. But if you do want to read some of the transcriptions, perhaps you're more of a fan of reading than you are listening, and I completely understand that. But we've got a lot of the transcriptions out there now. We are trying to get every single episode up there gradually. So if you want to read those or share them or whatever, then they are there. Now, that's pretty much it from me. Without further ado, let's jump in to the interview with Simon Clark from Motorama. So welcome to the show, Simon Clark. How are you?
Fantastic. How are you, Simon?
Not too bad at all. Now, you and I have kind of crossed each other's paths. As I mentioned in the intro that, you know, you guys are clients and we've crossed each other's paths a few times in the past. But currently you're working for Motorama. For those people who are perhaps outside of Southeast Queensland or maybe even haven't bought a car for a long time, can you give us a bit of an overview as to who Motorama actually are?
Yeah, sure. So Motorama is a family-owned business, been in operation since 1960. It's been a growing business in the last few years. We've certainly diversified a lot. But basically the core business is automotive retail and servicing cars. So we've got a couple of the mainstream brands, Toyota, Holden, Ford, Mitsubishi, Kia, Nissan, HSV, and that keeps us relatively busy. We're sort of spread over three geographic locations on the south side of Brisbane, Maruka, Browns Plains and Springwood. And I guess in the last few years, we've diversified the business by sort of expanding into a bit of a finance brokerage, building another sort of used car warehouse, and just been experimenting, I guess, as the automotive market sort of disrupts and evolves. I guess the business has been challenged quite well in the last few years, and we've sort of been trying to evolve with it.
So a couple of questions out of that. Family-owned business. I've actually had a couple of family-owned business people on here. I spoke to the chairman of Coopers in an earlier episode, which is obviously a very famous family-owned business. What sort of generation are they into now? Because obviously saying it started in the 1960s. Are there a lot of the family still involved in the business, or is it just sort of one or two?
Yeah, no, we've still got, so third generation, the son of, so the grandfather, Jan, the son, his son, John, and then his son, Mark, is now the CEO. He's been in place for, I think he's worked through the business. So he started in the business and has sort of worked his way through all different roles and is now managing director. And his brother, Damien, is our group training manager. So we still quite involvement, and John is still involved at a board level as well. So there's still a strong family connection and a family direction that goes into what they want the business to be doing. And yeah, so it's actually quite interesting to, I guess, having worked in different industries to then come and work at a family-owned business. It's it's been quite different.
And the other thing I wanted to pick up on in your intro there was that diversification bit, and we might as well talk about it now. But the car industry is one of those ones that is an industry to me that was perhaps one of the first ones to go through that kind of disruption and that sort of challenging space where there was new kind of concepts and new ideas. But it's also one of the industries that I feel is continually going through disruption. It is continually being hammered by, you know, new concepts, new ideas, left, right, and center. Is that the reason, the core reason for you guys sort of looking for, you know, diversification opportunities?
Yeah, look, absolutely. The market, the automotive world is continuing to evolve, and you know, particularly in Australia, the volume of cars that are being sold has been increasing for the last few years. Probably the last 6 months has been some of the toughest trading that we've actually seen in quite a while. And we're also seeing, I guess, within the automotive landscape, a lot more large players. We're seeing the AP Eagers, the AHGs of the world that are continuing to buy up other smaller dealerships. So the idea of just having a single franchise on the side of the road and trying to make a good business out of it, those days are kind of going because now you really need scale. So you need to either be buying up other businesses to create the scale, or you need to be looking internally at your own business to look at how you can scale to evolve yourself. So we've been spending a lot of time as a senior management team looking at how we can continually be more efficient as a group and how we can and just generate that scale of efficiency over time. Yeah, so we've also just been looking as well at how can we get a better utilization of our assets. So assets for us are cars. We own cars. We have lots of cars. But traditionally they'll sit on the lot for 40 days to 60 days to 90 days, depending on, you know, what the model is. So we've also been looking at how we can, and we're also obviously playing floor plan at that point. So we're trying to look at how we can get a return on those cars and sort of work through the systems and the processes that manufacturers put in place and sort of play the game to have asset utilization at all time. So one of the concepts we've sort of developed and been working on just sort of started over in the US. It's not by any means our own idea, but it's certainly been one of the first moves in that space is around car subscription and looking at how we can set up pools of cars that people can access for short term, i.e. month at a time, to sort of help either help them out of a problem at the time or to also offer them choice and flexibility that they wouldn't traditionally have. And what I mean by that is I think when you go to buy a car, you're always having a trade-off around something. You and your wife probably have a different idea on what you think is a suitable family car. You probably think, yeah, well, I'd love a ute to, you know, for those weekend trips that you envisage. And your wife goes, yeah, and I'd love a seven-seater for all those times when, you know, we need to have seven seats occupied by taking kids to school and soccer trips and what have you. So what we're seeing with Motorpool is that you can overcome that by, rather than just buying one car, you actually subscribe to a pool of cars. So you have six different cars in a pool. You're always driving one of the cars, but when your need arises or a weekend trip or you need to go to that soccer game, you can essentially swap out of the car and swap into, you know, a different car that will suit your need for that point in time.
It kind of strikes me that from a subscription point of view, that should have kind of happened earlier. Do you think they, you know, because, you know, Spotify's been around for a long time, Netflix has been around, I mean, I say long time in terms of, you know, internet age, you know, and there's a lot of other subscription services that have been around for a while. It seems strange that the car industry has only just started to embrace that, embrace the idea. Do you think that's because it was so hard for the traditional car industry to understand that concept, or do you think it was that it's actually quite hard doing a car subscription? I don't know how easy you guys have found, you know, and obviously, you know, I've been involved in it to a degree with you guys, but has it been hard for you to kind of work it all out from a numbers point of view?
Yeah, look, there's been a few challenges. First of all, it's, I think car ownership is something that's very near and dear to a lot of Australians. I think, you know, we've got a lot of geography here. So for you to go anywhere, you essentially need a car. And I think for certainly our generation and the generations either side, I think owning that car has always been aspirational and that ticket to freedom. And, you know, I guess with the rise of other mobility solutions, Uber's making, you know, transportation a lot cheaper and other short-term driving packages being available, I don't know that car ownership is as desirable as it used to be, particularly for the younger generation, which is where, you know, car subscription seems to have a space. So we've been sort of just struggling a little bit with trying to understand who the market is. And as we've sort of gone out there, we've kind of just gone with a very broad approach and, you know, just sort of identifying different areas. And it's, it's been an interesting journey because within Motorpool, we have also just sort of started to segment as well different pools. So, you know, you've got the customer that likes to show off to the neighbours with a different car every week and it's a high-end car. So we've kind of got a premium pool, which sort of talks to that highly aspirational and person that likes to show pony their car, so to speak, but also is probably more that car advocate and likes to change cars and have the latest and greatest. And then from our research and just from talking with the people, we've also then started to evolve that into a pool that's probably more around we call a value pool. So that's sort of not as fancy a car, but it really sort of just hones back in on those people that just need a car that gets from A to B and for whatever reason don't have the upfront money to go and buy a car. They actually like the flexibility that they don't have to lock in on one particular model or they just need something for a short-term time period, or use it even as a test drive to test drive a car for 3 months to then decide if that's actually the car they want to buy.
You talk about that car ownership being part of the, you know, the Australian psyche, that, you know, and obviously geography is a major issue as well. I think it's something that I think the car manufacturers have done over the years is to make people believe that owning a car was a natural part of growing up. You know, as soon as you turn 17, and well, back in the UK, as soon as you turn 17, you go out and you buy your car and all those kind of things. So I think really that psychological breakthrough, I think, you know, you're completely right. I think Uber has done a fair job in you know, breaking that. And there's, you know, there's now stories coming out of places like LA where kids aren't, you know, teenagers aren't actually learning to drive anymore. They're just getting an Uber subscription that's paid for by their parents, and that's how they get about now. So, you know, I think it's starting to break. But I also think for the older generation, I've just lumped myself in the older generation there using a we. But I think we've never had any alternative, you know. And I think as Uber arrives and as car subscription arrives, and later on maybe as autonomous vehicles arrive, suddenly we all sit there and go, yeah, you know what? That kind of concept of actually owning a car wasn't a very good idea, but it was natural because it was the only idea out there. So you didn't really have any other alternatives but to own a car if you wanted to get from A to B.
No, I remember back when I was at uni, and if I wanted to catch the bus or, you know, relying on public transport, because there wasn't an Uber, as a uni student, you couldn't exactly afford to get a taxi.
Yeah.
It used to take me an hour and a half to catch a bus that would basically take me 20 minutes to go for in a car.
Absolutely.
Suddenly your whole need and wants to get a car is completely rational because, well, it's going to save me so much time all the time. So, but yeah, no other alternative back then.
Yeah, and as much as people would like to say, you know, we should rely more on public transport and things like that, you know, you hit the nail on the head there where you just say it's a time issue. You know, for me to catch a bus, it's a, you know, 10, 15 minute walk to the closest bus stop. And then it's probably not going to take me anywhere near where I actually need to go. And, you know, you start thinking about buses and trains, and you're almost doubling journey time, if not tripling journey time sometimes. And people just won't buy into that. So there was actually one other question I wanted to ask you, and something you said earlier on about the last 6 months being the hardest trading period that you guys have ever experienced. And having spoken to, you know, other people where I've done, you know, test drives of other cars and stuff in the last 6 months, they all say the same thing, and you read the newspapers and blah, blah, blah. Why do you think that's the case? Why has it been in the last 6 months? That it's been such a challenge? Is it an economy thing? Is it that the consumer is just, I don't know, just looking for alternatives now? I mean, what do you think's the behind that?
I think there's been a few things. There's been a few factors affecting it. So certainly from an economic perspective, we've seen house prices softening, which often is kind of goes hand in hand, I think, with car purchase. If your house goes up, people feel rich. What do richer people do? Oh, it's a good time to upgrade the car or invest. So that whole confidence thing goes hand in hand. And as house prices get in the media and, you know, they talk up the, oh, it's flat, you know, the market's sort of been flattening, certainly in Brisbane anyway, and, you know, but they still reference Sydney and Melbourne markets more so. So I think consumer confidence has been a struggle. I think even from the business side of things, we've had a lot of restrictions around what we can do from a finance perspective. So our finance income as a business has been quite heavily impacted just by changes that have been happening from ASIC in terms of reduction and tightening up of lending. So we've had some struggles there. Yes, and I also see that wage growth has also been quite stagnant. So I don't know that people have that, you know, disposable income to spend as well at this point. So, yeah, it's just been a toughening time, I think, and the manufacturers have also sort of, you know, everyone increases their expectation of where where they want to go in terms of volume. And when the market's not there, they get more desperate to encourage you to put demos on or do different things to try and manufacture a result. So those cars still have to go somewhere. It's one thing to, you know, turn a car from a stock into a demonstrator, but then the demonstrator still lives somewhere and they still have to be sold. So you can only sell a car once, really, to record a number within VFAX or from a market share perspective.
I just want to touch on a couple of your brands, because obviously, you know, you spent some time working for Toyota, and we'll talk about that from, you know, from both a franchise and a franchisee perspective. But I wanted to touch on Holden, because Holden's a big brand for you guys. Holden has undergone a massive change, evolution, whatever you want to call it, in the past, you know, perhaps 3 or 4 years. And again, for people that don't know and don't know the Australian marketplace, Holden was once very proudly built in Australia, or at least, you know, put together in Australia, that kind of thing. And then they closed their last manufacturing plant. Whew, how long ago would that be? 18 months?
Couple of years, yeah.
Couple of years, yeah.
Yeah.
Made a lot of people redundant, and took the manufacturing overseas, or at least it was overseas anyway, but, you know, returned it back to, you know, where it was. Where do they manufacture them now?
So they come from a few different spots. They have some cars coming mainly from America, as I understand it. So, yeah, they're going through an interesting time, Holden.
I'm going to guess this is a really obvious question, but did that impact their brand and their brand value in the face of the Australian marketplace?
Oh, massively. Yeah, they've been in a world of hurt for a number of years now. Just from a volume perspective, so obviously they're selling less cars, but the model lineup has changed. So back in the last sort of 10, 15 years, Holden and Toyota for a number of years were neck and neck as number one and two. And just, you know, as products change and consumers change, the Holden product has really just sort of fallen away. And Toyota's maintained its sort of lead, and Holden now, I think last I saw, was about six. So they've kind of been in free fall, and the decision to sort of back away from the Australian manufacturing, and particularly some of the really popular nameplates like Commodore that, you know, you used to see racing at Bathurst every weekend, which really created a really strong brand advocate for Holden. As that sort of moved away, that core supporter base is kind of fragmented a little bit from what Holden actually had. And now they're not making cars here. They're actually importing a lot of cars from General Motors in the US. And it's just taken a little while for those brands and those nameplates to really have any sort of traction in the Australian market.
Do you think the decline in the brand was a consequence of shutting the plants, or was shutting the plants a consequence of the declining brand?
I think shutting the factory and the subsequent change of models has been what's impacted Holden mostly. Because, you've just broken that traditional model mix that people liked and loved about Holden has been changed. And the fact that now it's not made in Australia, because really the Holden brand doesn't exist anywhere else in the world other than Australia. Essentially it's General Motors having the brand Holden in Australia.
Vauxhall in the UK, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
So now everything basically is a GM car that's imported, rebadged as the Holden, and on it goes. So, yes.
And I think the other thing is that a lot of the manufacturers stepped up their game. It might not necessarily be that Holden was doing anything wrong, you know, for that decline, but it was that, you know, perhaps they didn't adjust to the marketplace quickly enough, and that, you know, there's a lot of other brands that sort of, you know, stepped up and started producing good quality, maybe cheaper, maybe, you know, more features and all that kind of thing. I mean, you guys deal with Kia as well?
Yep.
Yeah.
The Australian market, the Australian manufacturer, the number of manufacturers in the Australian market is actually the highest in the world.
Right,
so we annually would sell like about 1.1 million cars.
Yeah.
And I believe there's about 60 different manufacturers here. And wow. The reason that Australia is so attractive is because it is that smaller market. Like 1.1 isn't huge in the context of the world, but it's a great place and brands love coming here to test things out and use it as a bit of a pilot sort of place to come.
Yeah.
So it creates this massively competitive environment. And yeah, as you said, we've seen other brands that are continually evolving and changing products and becoming stronger and increasing their value propositions.
Yeah.
And are really just stealing share off everyone else. And I think now that the switching, and I think that brand loyalty is certainly something that we've seen decline over the time. I think a few years back, there was a real difference in real point of difference in quality between different brands, but now it is very hard to tell.
Yeah, like the difference. Absolutely. I mean, I was talking to someone yesterday about Skodas, and they were going on about how great they thought a Skoda was, and essentially, you know, Skoda used to be the joke car, you know, and pretty what 15 years ago, not long ago, from in car terms, you know, and now it's built on the platform of a, you know, a Volkswagen, and you know, and everyone's talking about how, you know, good and robust it is. And again, when I first came to Australia in early 2000s, I bought, just to mention Kia again, I bought a Kia and it was terrible. you know, and now everyone sort of goes, everyone who's ever driven a sort of Kia Sportage just goes on about how, you know, how great they are. And, you know, it's changed quite dramatically. I mean, it's taken time, but it's, you know, it's perhaps a very different marketplace than it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, and I think speaking of Kia, I think Kia is probably one of the most underrated brands out there. It's ironic because, you know, we have the luxury of dealing with six different brands, and most people come to us and say, oh, I'm thinking about buying this or this. And a lot of the time, like internally, even myself, we would say, oh, I've actually thought about the equivalent Kia model.
Yeah.
Like the Kia brand, I mean, they sort of lead the market with a 7-year warranty, which most of the manufacturers are now sort of caught up and gone with a 5-year unlimited kilometre warranty. Kia's always been at 7, and they moved to that a number of years ago. And as soon as they did that, it just gave so much more confidence to the consumer that, oh, wow, 7-year warranty, how good is this? Yeah. And then they actually get in there and they start driving the car, and they value add it with so many features that it becomes a compelling proposition to go, well, I get all this value, I get a 7-year warranty versus the competitor set. So, yeah, it's really changed perception, and they've come a long way in that sort of last 10 to 15 years. And I think they've also picked up the sponsorship of the Australian Open for them has been really strong. So, ironically, they took it off, I think it was Ford used to sponsor it for years, and then Kia picked it up and, you know, it's one of those, you know, you look at those sponsorships, it only goes for 2 weeks of the year, but it's sort of got a bit of clear space. It sort of runs in that January period where, you know, a lot of people are outside of their normal routine, kids aren't at school, a lot of people have a bit more time on their hands to watch TV and watch sport. And, you know, they now leverage it quite well to sort of bring in new models and really push different marketing agendas through that. I picked up the sponsorship of Rafael Nadal as well. So created a few little limited edition models around that. So they really use that as a good leapfrog as well for the dealer network. So, you know, most of the manufacturers now use kind of these sponsorship events as a way to get all the dealers together for a reason. Plus, they can go off and wine and dine them at the tennis, but also use it to release new models and to then showcase that to, you know, the huge number of people that they get through at the Australian Open as well, because they'll be having on-ground activations and whatever to really get that Kia brand out there and just really push it more into the mainstream.
That's an interesting point that you make about sponsorship of the Australian Open. And I think a lot of people don't really think of sponsorship like that. They go, you know, sponsorship of the Australian Open is about, you know, getting a logo in front of the general public and getting, you know, your brand exposed to those eyeballs on TV. But it's also an opportunity for you to engage with, you know, partners and suppliers and, you know, franchisees, or anybody that might be part of your business network that helps sell your product. So it doesn't necessarily need to be all about the end user. It can be, you know, it can be about building a relationship with those people who are working with your brand day in, day out. So I think that's a really important point. I did a couple of other things I want to talk about disruption, since we're sort of on that subject. So subscription cars, I think most people who, certainly people I've spoken to, goes, well, that makes a lot of sense, you know, and you sort of go, everything's included except your petrol and your tolls. You're just paying one flat fee. You know, you can cancel at any time. I think people who are scared that they're going to get stuck with a lemon that they owe $40,000 and it's worth 25 or something at the end of a 5-year term or something like that, this is a really kind of, it's a safety net. It's a, you know, something less that you need to worry about. So I think subscription cars makes complete sense. And I think anybody that is looking at buying a car today needs to go, I've now got two options. Number one, buy one. Number two, subscribe to one. I think people would be stupid not to even just look at that as a possibility. The other two go on. Yeah,
I was just going to say, I think that's what we're seeing. When we talk to people, I reckon everyone I've spoken to around car subscription can see that, yes, it's a great idea. And then you can see them doing the sums in their head going, yeah, well, actually, yeah. And they all ask the same sort of couple of questions. And I think it's sort of like you were saying before, it's just one of those things where people just kind of got to get the vibe of it and kind of get the understanding of how it works, because everyone can kind of see and everyone kind of, I think, understands that, yes, car ownership is one thing, but there are obviously the costs that are involved with it. I think RSEQ only just came out recently and sort of said that the average cost to own and maintain just a medium-sized passenger car was around $850 a month.
Yeah.
Which includes fuel. And then when you look at car subscription, we offer a car subscription that starts at $990 a month. And, you know, that's putting you into a brand new car that's, you know, got very limited number of kilometres on it that, you know, has the latest safety and features. So it does make for a compelling thought discussion as well, just around the flexibility that it gives you as well. So
I want to touch on a couple of other disruption things that I think, and this is kind of looking further into the future as opposed to right now. I think the two things that are obviously on everyone else's front of mind is, number one is electric cars. Number two is autonomous cars, autonomous driving. So let's take the electric cars first, because I've test drove a Hyundai, God, whatever it was called. Can't remember what it was called now. There you go. Anyway, that's how much impact it had on me. From a drive perspective, an amazing drive, you know, and the sort of car that when you put your foot down at 90 kilometers an hour, it goes like you were, it accelerates like you were putting your foot down at 20 kilometers an hour. I guess my question for you is how you see, you know, you guys are in that industry, you kind of up to date, finger on the pulse, hopefully, with everything that's happening there. What do you see as the impact is with electric cars in the Australian marketplace?
Yeah, look, I think it's going to be interesting. Tesla have made is probably the most widely known car brand out there from an electric car perspective, and I guess the recent weeks have made some very interesting decisions and backflips on what their model looks like, because they're a very unique, just a distribution model outside of just the car, because they actually, you know, predominantly buy online, and they work on, and I've actually got a mate who owns a Tesla, and he's very active in sort of recruiting and trying to find new Tesla owners. So they actually had a really cool product referral program, basically, where you would refer customers, and they would, when they buy their car, they would put your code on, and based on the number of times that you actually generated, you know, sales in the quarter, you actually earn different levels of rewards within the Tesla program. So it's a completely new way of actually selling cars versus the traditional dealership model where, you know, we make the cars, we flick them out to you as the dealership, and then you will on-sell them. So the Tesla model does away with dealers and does it all direct. So that whole model itself is quite interesting to look at how that works. I guess from the brands that we own, a lot of them have probably gone more down the hybrid path. So hybrid being a combination of a petrol engine and an electric engine. And certainly some of our brands, probably Toyota is probably the leader in that space in terms of hybrid technology. And I think they have a plan where pretty much all their cars, as they roll out new models, will be coming in a petrol and a hybrid variant. So we're now starting to see that a lot more fleets and businesses are now starting to look at that going, well, actually, the hybrid model actually stacks up better because of the fuel efficiency saving that you get by driving a hybrid can actually, based on a certain number of kilometres, be better than actually just buying a straight petrol. And I guess as that technology has also improved and been out there, like hybrid technology has probably been out there for 15 to 20 years, started with Prius, as most people would recognise that name. That technology has obviously improved, got cheaper, the battery life has got better. And one of the things that I guess you always see there's a bit of a first mover is that a lot of the mobility Uber taxis out there, they're all hybrids. So the big issue that hybrids had originally, I think, was just around the battery reliability. Oh, the battery's not going to last, you know, there's no range. But having a petrol and an electric actually gives you probably the best of both worlds. It's probably the best technology solution at the moment. I think electric cars are also going to be found out to actually be quite probably not that good for the environment just in producing them. There's a lot of work that goes into actually producing it, producing the battery, that is actually counterintuitive to people that actually want to do good for the environment and, you know, drive a car that doesn't emit fuels. But actually the costs and stuff that goes into actually making it kind of is a little bit detrimental to that.
I think the other thing for electric cars that I've seen is that they are generally not particularly attractive cars for some reason. And I don't know whether that's the manufacturer sort of trying to put people off or whatever it is, but certainly the Hyundai that I drove wasn't a good-looking car. The Teslas, obviously, you know, are attractive cars without a doubt. But and I think the Audi e-tron, I think, is obviously a very, you know, a very nice-looking car that's apparently, you know, smashing some records in the US in terms of sales. I think the hybrids are, you know, a great option. It's interesting that you say that Holden are starting to, Toyota are starting to bring out current models with hybrid engines, because I think that's the way forward, you know. Creating these kind of individual brands with hybrid engines.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the Prius has been a very polarizing car. Some people love it and a lot of people don't like the look of it.
Yeah.
But it was traditionally, and that's where Toyota started, well, that's our hybrid. And then as they've, their big move really was getting it into the Camry. So you had a Camry that was a petrol Camry and then you had a hybrid Camry.
Yeah.
And everyone who drove the hybrid Camry, which looked exactly the same, other than, you know, in the car there's the little hybrid battery that you can kind of tell. We're like, oh, my God, this is just amazing. Because it is actually a better drive. It's actually two engines. In a hybrid, you actually have two engines. You have a petrol and electric engine.
Yeah.
It actually tweaks and you actually get a little bit more kick out of the car than you would traditionally. So, I think moving into mainstream and making hybrids just another version has been a really good move. And they've also reduced that price premium. So when, you know, like any new technology, when it comes out, it's like, oh, if you want to get a hybrid, it's going to cost you, you know, so much more. I think now the current Corolla, so the new Corolla, which just came out last year, comes in a petrol and a hybrid. Right. I think for the hybrid version is now only $1,500 more than the petrol. Right. So that price disparity is fantastic.
And you should save that on petrol, like, you know, within a year, really, I'm guessing, you know, given the,
Absolutely. Given the price
of petrol these days.
And to my other point, what you're also seeing is that the mobility sector, so the Uber drivers, the taxi drivers, that market all want to own a hybrid. Yeah. So when you go to resell your car, if you're reselling a hybrid versus a petrol, you're probably going to attract a bit more of a premium because there's just going to be more demand for that Uber driver to go and buy a hybrid. So it's kind of now starting to pull, you know, that it's rather than just being all push, it's now a bit of push and pull so that, you know, the used car market is now sort of pulling and looking for hybrid stuff, and you know, it makes it a bit easier to sort of that whole of life value.
We're gradually running out of time here, and there's about 20 other things I want to ask you. So I'm going to try and pick three key things. Number one, autonomous cars are a very, 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 very polarizing, you know, conversation. And for those that know me, I have various online arguments with other people about whether they will happen or they won't happen and to what level they'll happen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What's your opinion? Is it going to happen? What level is it going to happen? And are we talking about 2 or 3 years, or are we talking about 20 years here?
Yeah, look, I think it's still a little while away. There's so much legislative issues that they need to sort out. Like, who's, you know, if you've got two autonomous cars driving and one crashes into the other, who's at fault from an insurance perspective? Is it the manufacturer? Is it the software? You know, so I think there's a lot of legalities to come out. I think it's a nice notion, and you know, we'll probably get there eventually, but I think there's a long way to go with that at this point. So, it's probably not something really on the radar at this point. But I think it's a little while away.
The other question I wanted to, which is completely different to the future of autonomous cars, is the whole concept of selling secondhand cars. You know, when people talk about selling secondhand cars, there's this, you know, there's that kind of typical vision of a secondhand car salesman trying to, you know, it's con you or make you pay more for something that isn't worth something, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think even today, you know, in 2019, there is still that kind of apprehension that when you go into a secondhand car lot or yard or warehouse or whatever, that there is, it's going to be some sort of battle. How do you guys, from a marketing perspective, deal with that kind of consumer attitude? I mean, I guess my first question is, does that consumer attitude still exist? And second thing, if it does, how do you guys tackle it?
Yeah, look, I think it's a good question. We certainly have seen within the used car market, and we've been looking at the market for probably the last couple of years and just sort of understanding where it's been moving, and really look, I suppose, a lot to the US market. The used car market over there is absolutely massive, and we've actually taken a few pointers from that. Just recently, we have rebranded all our Motorama used car businesses to what we now call as Motorama Pre-Owned, and part of that really is just really trying to improve and increase the transparency to the customer. So a couple of the value propositions we've now moved to is to a haggle-free purchase experience. We've really noticed that providing a haggle-free purchase experience just makes everything so much smoother. But obviously you still need to have some ability to explain to the customer how you've arrived at that price. So we're now working a lot more and looking at a lot of the third-party lead providers that we use, Gumtree, Car Sales, et cetera, and just sort of looking at where our cars sit relative to the market and making sure that when we price the car, we actually price the car relative, you know, to the actual market. I think the traditional model has been, we think the car's worth this, so we'll just add a couple of grand to it, and then when the customer comes in, we'll see how much we can negotiate and keep in, and we'll see how much they can negotiate to get the price down. But now moving across to a haggle-free model has been really good from a customer experience perspective. It speeds up the time because there's no back and forth, there's no argy-bargy, and just even just looking at our own sort of reviews and customer experience metrics, it's been really positive.
Has it increased sales, or has it made a difference for you guys from a bottom line perspective?
Well, we've only been doing it to date for about six weeks.
Right.
But just looking at the February data, we actually grossed more money out of the cars, and we actually generated as many, if not more, leads than we had in January, which is generally traditionally a very strong month from a used car perspective. But because you're now pricing cars to market, so the car now goes on to the third-party lead provider, price to market,
yeah.
So i.e. it's now relative to the other cars and now looks attractive. It's not priced out of the market with a margin on top. you actually generate more leads naturally anyway.
Yeah.
So we're actually generating more leads, making more money and having a better customer experience. So it's actually going hand in hand and working quite well today.
My last question before we get into the sort of final run is I'm going to take you back all the way to 1998 and 1999. Your first job or one of your first jobs was working for what I would probably class as one of the iconic vehicle brands out there, or I mean, I don't know where they sit in terms of, you know, that commercial space, but John Deere, which, you know, everybody who's, I mean, most people would know what, you know, John Deere, you know, tractors and those kind of things. Tell us a little bit about that brand and about, you know, how they, was there anything that that brand did that you thought was unique, or, and I know it was back in 1998, 99, but, you know, perhaps that you still see today that makes them stand out above everybody else?
Yeah, John Deere was an interesting time. I was actually, they're actually making a foray back then into Asia. So obviously John Deere is a big American company. All the production was in America. And then they were just eyeing off trying to get into the whole Asian sphere. So they actually set up an office in Australia to, because of the time zone, to sort of start working with the a couple of John Deere dealers there. From a branding perspective, it was interesting even back then, and I guess I don't follow them as closely now as I did, but they're always very innovative, just in what they were doing and products they were offering, to the point where, you know, you could some of the technology that they had even back then, which was looking at the amount of yield that you could get on certain parts of your crop and mapping that data back into, you know, to look at how much yield you get from your whole crop and then whether or not there's certain sections of a crop that actually generate more yield than others, or it's more productive than other areas. So they were just very innovative and at the forefront, and that sort of stuff now I would assume is a lot more mainstream, but, you know, this was 20 years ago and that was some pretty awesome product. So,
and that seems to go beyond their remit of making tractors, analyzing crop, you know, yields and those kind of things. That seems to be a step beyond what they were actually there to do. Does that sound right?
Oh, absolutely. I think it was just becomes a value add, right? So the tractor does one thing. It does the grunt work, but where's the science behind it? So I think by building that ecosystem and building the science behind it and overlaying that into the brand, I think that really helped to sort of set them apart. And that, you know, it was interesting because they were a very traditional company. They'd been building tractors and, you know, and products for a number of years. So for them to be evolving even back then, I think was, it was really good. And they had just such an awesome reputation as well from a supply chain and distribution perspective. I think it gave the customers there a lot of confidence that, you know, if something did happen to your product, that there was, you know, someone on hand that would be able to fix it or find the part for it as well, just because of their sheer size.
We'll jump into the last three questions. We're not going to get probably a chance to talk about the whole franchisee experience with Toyota, which is a bit of a shame. But I guess my third to last question for you, I normally talk to people about brands that they like or brands that they admire, but I'm going to make the question slightly different for you. If money was no object and you were going out to buy a car tomorrow and you've got a pocket full of cash, what would you be driving? Put you on the spot.
Interesting question. I mean, I'm probably more an A to B car driver. You know, I think you segment people and you go, well, these people like to have the latest and greatest fancy car, and then there's other people that just like, I just need a car to get from A to B. So I'd probably say I'd drive a Land Cruiser 200 series or something, just something big and that can go anywhere, can tow anything. So it's probably a little bit boring, but
blinged up, you know, maybe with the big alloys and you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, of course, yeah. You'd have a few bits and pieces hanging off it that would kind of make it look pretty definitive and pretty cool.
What's the worst feature that you've ever seen people, and you must have seen a few, but the worst feature that you've ever seen people put on their cars? if that makes sense, like, you know, as an addition?
A few people like to put funny colours, you know, or they kind of put decals that look like tattoos on their cars, which kind of look really weird. It's kind of like those, you know, the stickers you see on the back of the car that, you know, have the My Family type ones, These are like really big ones that they put on the front. So, there's some people have some strange ideas about what sort of looks good in their mind.
I drove a 3 Series BMW, which someone had decided, I bought it secondhand, but someone had decided to put this massive spoiler on the back, which was just, and I never thought about it at the time. And I look back on it now and I just go, oh God, it was just terrible. And then I had a friend with those underbody UVs, you know, so that when they to drive the car, there was the UV lights underneath them. And people do some strange things with cars.
Especially people that lower them as well. I never understand the people that lower the car so close to the ground. It's like, how do you get into a car park with speed bumps? And surely that's the worst sound, is to hear your car scraping over something as you drive in.
Yeah, that's not a good sound. That's not a good sound. All right, so second to last question. What's your big focus for 2019? Where are you spending your time, you know, from a marketing perspective?
Well, there's probably a couple of areas for us. At the moment, customer review. So we've really been playing hard in the Google, Facebook review space, and really trying to focus on, first and foremost, having a really good customer experience. So part of, I guess, moving our business to that pre-owned model, haggle-free, really strong value propositions has really helped to improve the whole review perspective. But we're also actually using a product called Podium, which is a really good way to amplify your reviews, but also to look at your competitors to sort of understand where your reviews sit relative to your competition. So, for example, we pull up all our Kia data. We look at all our brands, but let's take Kia, for example. Look at our Kia dealership, and we look at the number of reviews that we've generated. What's our score? What's our most recent score? And how does that actually sit relative to the market in Brisbane that we're comparing ourselves against? So we really want to get to the point where we are the number one dealer of choice for the brands that we have in our location, so in Brisbane. Because I think that the way that consumer behaviour is going is that everyone now just Googles and looks at a Google review before they do business, right? So if I'm deciding where I'm going to have a donut today, I'm going to go and Google best donut places in Brisbane, right? Yeah. And that's to spend $3 on a donut.
Is that what you do every morning, is it? Best.
let alone spending $30,000 on a car, right? Yeah. So I think if you then just gives you that peace of mind that you look and go, oh, my God, look at this. I've got 200 reviews and you're at 4.7 out of 5.
Yeah.
Geez, that looks like a pretty good place to go and buy my car. And funnily enough, being the marketing guy, my wife and I just built a house recently, and I reckon every tradie that I use had to have a Google star rating of above 4.
And I tell you what, you know, I bet 90% of the tradies out there don't even realise that that's how it works now.
Oh, it was fascinating because, you know, just talking to them saying, oh, so what do you guys do for customer reviews? And none of them actually have any sort of active strategy around generating more reviews. Or one of the bigger companies was like, yeah, I really should do more of that, but I just don't have time. It's like, mate, seriously, the best thing you can do as a business, I think, is to be generating reviews and then using social media to be pushing the products that you've done. So from a housing perspective, it's like, mate, just do a before and after. Yeah. Inspire me about, you know, what my landscaping could look like, because I don't know what I don't know. And, you know, you've probably done some awesome stuff, but Facebook's the perfect medium to actually get it out.
I could probably count one tradie that has ever asked me to put a review somewhere. Maybe two. In all the work that I've ever had done, you know. I mean, the guy who built my fence recently didn't even have a website. So I'm like, well, I mean, I can't even remember how I found him, but, you know, anyway, beside the point, but I can't imagine he's, you know, got, or maybe he has, just got a shitload of work rolling in from recommendations. But
yeah, look, it's great. Imagine how much more you'd have though. Maybe,
oh yeah, you know. yeah. And well, and the thing is, then I have these conversations with tradies, and they say to me, "Yeah, but I'm busy already." And you go, "Right, but they'll two things. Number one, there'll come a day when you're not busy. You know, you can't possibly say to me that you are fully booked. You know, in massive demand, 52 weeks of the year. It's just not possible. Mm. So what will happen is one day, all of a sudden, you won't get inquiries for a couple of weeks, and then you'll start to panic." You know, so that's one thing. The second thing I'd go is, if you get even more inquiries than the ones you're already getting at the moment, you've got the option of then sending those jobs out to third parties, to contractors that you can trust, which means you make more money, or you put your prices up. If you're in that much demand, start, you know, put your prices up by 10%. So it doesn't necessarily mean getting good reviews doesn't necessarily mean to people that you're going to get more business. It can also mean good reviews can actually translate to charging more money.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
A lot of them just do not realize that at all.
Mm. But it just gives you so much more confidence in using that, you know, that tradie, that you can see that that they're active and think about it, but B, that they've just generated, you know, such a good number of reviews and goodwill that people are willing to recommend them. So it always does my head a bit when you start talking to tradies and they just have no concept of it, you know.
There's a market, there's a business out there helping tradies.
There is.
Helping tradies understand this. But then the problem is, then you have to deal with tradies all the time. So that itself is
a challenge. Yeah, challenge. Yes. Correct.
So, and apologies to any tradies listening to this. We know how wonderful you all are. It's just sometimes your communication isn't great. That's all I'm going to say on that one. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Last question. If anybody wants to contact you, you know, they're looking for, they're not going to come to you to buy a car, but because they've got, you know, there's a lot of brands out there. But if they're looking to contact you, what's the best way of getting hold of you? I know you're on LinkedIn, but anything else that you're
I'm on LinkedIn, or they can just shoot me an email.
Cool. I'll put your email in the
links up.
Yeah, I'll put your email in the show notes as well. But
yeah, cool.
Look, mate, thank you very much for that. No doubt we will catch up very soon. I think, in fact, I'm even catching up with you later on today. So I which is kind of weird having this conversation and then seeing you later on. It will be like awkward after a first date. But thank you very much for your time, mate. It's been great, and I really appreciate you being on the show.
Awesome. Thanks, Simon. Much appreciated.
That's pretty much it for today. Thank you very much for joining us on episode 59. We hope you will be able to stick around and listen to us for episode number 60. Otherwise, have the fantastic rest of your day, and look, we really appreciate you tuning in. Thank you again.